Society 13 Podcast Network. Redefining podcasts. Society-13.com.
I like to listen.
Welcome to Channel 9 of the STRY Radio Network, where stories live.
Before you listen to this podcast, be aware this show often uses very naughty language. If you don't like that, you shouldn't listen. Send your complaints to I Am a Whiny Baby with No Sense of Humor at nightstory.com or stop by the studio. I'll take you for a ride to a story of my choosing.
Out of the sweltering heat of summer, from the attic rafters of the ninth story. This is, in fact, the ninth story. I already blew it, but there you go. Welcome. I'm Jeanette Andromeda.
I'm Immortal Alexander. Wow. And voice crack.
And today we are interviewing one half of a pair of authors who have written a book together. And the half we are interviewing is John Brell.
Yes, John Brill, and this is the Ninth Story Podcast.
This is the Ninth Story Podcast, and this is episode 519. We are amazing, and that's why you listen to us. Good job.
His co-author is Joseph Sullivan, who's not on the show, but that's awesome that we get to hear a little bit more about their collaboration when we get into that. First, we're going to do a short story from their short story collection called At the Cemetery Gates, Year One.
And then we'll hear a little word from our sponsors who make it possible for us to keep doing this, and then we'll go right on into the interview.
An Epistle from the Dead by John Brell and Joe Sullivan. Regina Fleck had buried her remarkable husband, Thomas Fleck, in a most remarkable mausoleum. She had been full of pride during his eulogy. It was given by a state Supreme Court justice, and terrified at the prospect of a future without him. Days had passed since, and she sat with his objects in his study in remembrance of him. After looking through his desk and fingering his personal effects, Regina noticed the loosely bound manuscript, pulled it out, and began to read. This would resemble my diary had it been written. As a child, I watched a cat slowly die of dehydration. For days, I'd go into the woods behind my parents' home and listen to the cat cry. It was stuck in a drainage well and couldn't turn its body. I was amazed at its will to survive. On the fourth day, it rained heavily. The cat drowned. Regina sat with the neatly written series of pages, familiar with the handwriting. She didn't know what to make of the first few pages. The text seemed more a story told than a life lived. At school, I helped my teachers at their menial tasks, often staying well past the final bell. The other kids resented how they favored me. I would rummage through the personal possessions of the adults and children, study the comment cards and grade books. I didn't do it for test advantage, but to study the performance, punishments, and laurels of my peers. I needed to know each and every other intimately. My entire life had been dedicated to knowing, yet concealing. Regina became uneased and went to the kitchen for a drink, still clutching the papers. She skipped down the page, advancing the age of her husband, and began reading again. My first romantic attachments were to a neighborhood girl and a boy a year my elder who was employed by my father's gardener. My time spent with the weed puller caused the girl great consternation. She was sent to a facility for treatment. And of her prospects following, I've no knowledge. She was the closest I've ever felt to love. The young man's purpose to me was solely to cause jealousy. Once he was of no use, I prodded him to reveal himself to his father. He was severely beaten, and I haven't thought of him again until this moment. Regina trembled as she skipped to the middle of the following page. Why would Thomas write such things? I was attracted to Regina for her simple-mindedness. I knew early on she wouldn't delve too deeply into who I was. The more of me I hid from her, the more in control I felt. She wasn't fit to mother. I knew she'd struggle every hour caring for anything other than herself. There was a knocking at the front door, but it barely registered to Regina. She skimmed the pages that dealt with her, thinking of her virginity, childbirth, marriage. All of the great joys of her life were now tarnished. When I entered the public sphere, it was only to serve my own ends. To be thought of as an environmentalist was less advantage than I imagined. The reason I protected those stinking swamps from being paved and planted was only to put Arthur Brooks into Chapter 11. To my last day, I will hold his destitution and demise as my greatest work. Regina shook visibly, thinking of all the splendid dinners she had organized for the Audubon and other various foundations that she and Thomas had sat for. The knocking at the front door grew more insistent, but she was too caught up in the horror of her husband's text. It continued, describing the tax advantages of being a homeless shelter on one of the most chemically polluted sites in the country. She made a mental note to ask her staff about rates of cancer among those living at the shelter. I would have as easily tossed my children into the river at birth, as I merely mimed the role of father, nurturer, and provider. They certainly brought me no joy in their middling triumphs, nor any worry in their mundane defeats. How could a man love or cherish anything less than his measure? These adult children of mine, teacher, firefighter, family attorney, non-profit executive. She couldn't finish her husband's confession. She wept uncontrollably and tore the text into dozens of shredded strips, and then into minuscule bits and pieces, tossing them into the sink and running the disposal. A heavy crunching sound filled the quiet home, all the while someone was still banging on the front door. Regina turned to her husband's study, ignoring the rapping at the door and retrieving the revolver from his desk. Her hand, as if disassociated from her person, placed the barrel to her mouth and ended her life, just days after her remarkable husband's remarkable funeral. Thomas Fleck Jr. sat and mourned with his brother and two sisters after their mother's funeral. It was all too much for the siblings, two funerals and two parents gone within 2 weeks' time. Thomas, how could she? Oh, the fact that you were just outside, wailed his youngest sister, Allison. I'd forgotten the key in my excitement, replied Thomas. The schoolteacher had already told the story countless times. Holding the New Yorker in hand with his recently published story, spotting his mother's car in the driveway, knowing she was home, so happy to share his success with her in the midst of her mourning. And then the horror of the gunshot. I know it would have made her so proud to see your first story published, Tom, said Jennifer, his eldest sister, the attorney. I wanted it to be a surprise. I'd only shown Dad since it was such a black portrayal of someone of his stature. It was such a sloppy draft before I'd even changed all the names. His feedback was really what inspired me to finish and submit it, said Tom, openly weeping with his siblings. I would have loved for Mom to have read it. She had such a fondness for fiction. Thank you so much for listening. And now a short word from our sponsor before we get right on to the interview. Welcome, everybody, to the Ninth Story Podcast. This is episode 519. Today we have author John Brehel. Is that how you pronounce it? John Brehel?
It's actually Burrell.
Burrell. John Burrell. And today we're talking about his book with his co-author, Joseph Sullivan. And the book is called At the Cemetery Gates, Year One.
And if you pause for a moment and all you hear is silence, that is Joe speaking. Because true. He's mysterious and no one will ever see him.
Maybe not. Probably not.
That's okay. As a horror book and as horror authors, I think it's very fitting.
Yeah, I've told people before that he's a ghost. So I guess that if that works for you.
It definitely does.
All right, so welcome to the show, John. The book you shared with us, At the Cemetery Gates, Year One.
Short horror story collection?
Yeah, it'd be classified as that. which you co-wrote with Joseph Sullivan. Tell us how that partnership began.
It goes all the way back to probably first grade.
Oh, really?
Joe and I have known each other since elementary school, and we've been good friends ever since then, and we've done a lot of creative projects over the years. Like we used to be in a band together. We've written a bunch of songs, and it was really mostly music stuff for a while. And then we did a bunch of YouTube videos. We tried shooting this pseudo sitcom thing for a little while. And we've always been into writing and reading, and we always talk about scary stories and stuff over the years. And just a couple years ago, we decided to write this one book with the idea of, let's write a book like sort of based on or sort of inspired by scary stories to tell in the dark,
mm-hmm.
and set all the stories in one cemetery and have all these interconnections. We put out a few more books since then, so it's been great.
Nice. So is At the Cemetery Gates the second one then, or is this your first one?
This is actually our first collection of sort of not like a cohesive idea. Like, so Tales from Rainy View Cemetery, like I said, was all took place in this one cemetery. And then we had our second book was Marvelry's Curiosity Shop, and that was about those are all interconnected short stories as well that involved a magician and these haunted antiques and whatnot. And then so this is our third book, actually.
Nice. How does the co-writing process work between you and Joseph?
So it's kind of it's a little weird. I mean, sometimes we get together in person and write together and like kind of hash things out like one sentence at a time. But for the most part, I mean, we see each other maybe once a week, maybe once every other week, sometimes a little more than that. But for the most part, it's like Google Docs. We have Google Doc going all the time of whatever book we're working on. And generally, like, we'll hash out some sort of outline for the story. So we don't really write any story until we have, like, the whole, you know, inciting incident all the way to the, you know, to the end and whatnot. I'll pop in and write a few more paragraphs, and then he'll pop in and say what's wrong with all this stuff you wrote. and then I'll pop in and say what's wrong with all the stuff you wrote. And we kind of change each other's stuff back and forth. And so it's... But we've kind of figured out a way to sort of write, like, unify our styles together, so we're not, like, writing, like, you know, have completely two different voices.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we've kind of found over there. I don't know, we've kind of found, like, a sweet spot where we, we sound alike. I think we started with similar sensibilities anyway as the kind of writing we like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's just been easier to make that happen. We're not, like, it's not like trying to, have Hemingway paired up with Lewis Carroll or something. I mean, it's not like some totally disparate thing.
Yeah, as we were reading the stories, I really couldn't tell that there were multiple authors. It all felt very cohesive. So you guys do a really great job working together that way.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, that's the idea. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And John, how did you first get into writing in the first place?
I used to write stories a lot when I was little, that usually had mostly to do with writing comic books. So I had a comic book called Smiley Guy, for a couple of years. It was actually about this evil, it started a villain. So that was my first foray into, I guess, writing seriously, quote unquote. And then in terms of just being a writer overall, nonfiction, fiction, I was a freelance writer for a long time, in terms of writing marketing stuff, magazine stuff and whatnot.
That's awesome. So were you influenced by any writers, or what are some of your favorite writers that have really affected how you write and the storytelling that you tell?
Yeah, because I definitely think there's a difference between the writers I like and the kind of writers that I want to sort of emulate in a way. I mean, I don't want to completely emulate any writer. I want to do my own thing, or our own thing with me and Joe. I would say Richard Matheson is probably one of my biggest, my favorite writers ever. You guys familiar with him?
I have not, actually.
He wrote a lot of Twilight Zone episodes.
Oh.
I think that's where I might have first heard about him. That's the kind of stuff I just eat off. Like these kind of weird, fantastical, sort of scary stories that have a really crazy twist at the end. I just love that kind of stuff. So
yeah, I mean, I did watch a lot of Twilight Zone growing up. It's definitely still always stuck with me.
Oh yeah.
Oh, right on. Yeah, it's the best show ever. so yeah, Richard Matheson, he's a master of that sort of stuff. So I kind of would love to, write stories as great as he does.
Well, and based on At the Cemetery Gates, you definitely dove into that style, that just very concise, almost folklore style writing. In a way, it reminded me of the sketchbook of Gorian. Oh, I'm messing up the name. But the one with Sleepy Hollow in it. Why I can't remember that.
Washington Irving?
Yes. Thank you. Good Lord, my brain is just gone today. But Washington Irving's sketchbook, that one, it kind of reminded me of the stories in there where it felt very American folktale-ish. And again, you nailed the scary stories to tell in the dark. If people like that, they're going to really like your writing style. And I, as a fan of that, now I can come back to the question that I had for you before, which is the illustration on the front is amazing. And can you please tell me some more about Chad Wuerl and how you guys connected with him?
Yeah. So when we did that first book, Tales from Gravely Cemetery, like I said, we had the idea. We want to make this a scary stories thing. And so I was okay, where am I going to find this guy? I mean, you can go on DeviantArt. And so I just went to Instagram and I literally just put in the hashtag scary stories to tell in the dark. And just searched it. And he had, of course, tagged a lot of his art work with that style because he's a huge Stephen Gammell scary stories fan. And so I was like, Joe, this guy's perfect. Look at this guy.
And John, let's talk a little bit more about At the Cemetery Gates, year one. So I'm guessing you're intending to do more of these.
We intend on doing more. I don't think it's going to be an annual thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea with the year one thing was actually, it was sort of a celebration, whatnot, of our first year writing together as a duo.
And one of the stories that we read in the book was called The Burial Vault. Can you describe the basic setup for the audience?
Okay, cool. Yeah, so... So there's these group of friends, high school friends, who they meet up at this burial vault. They tell a story of this kid who was locked inside of this vault and ended up coming out and mauling people. And it was they're telling a legend within this actual legend that we're telling.
I really enjoyed this story. I enjoyed all of the stories, let's be honest. It was hard putting your book down. But this one in particular just felt so... This one felt a little Stephen King-y. And I think mostly because of that group of friends, kind of an It, where they have this mythos that they're building and then horrible things start happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really disturbing where that turned.
Cool. Yeah, we weren't thinking Stephen King at all. And going back to the thing you're talking about, folklore sort of stuff, we're really into that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of with the stories that we've been telling, and making them sort of these almost fairy tales, sort of, just legends and not really writing them specifically as like stylized short stories as much.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to actually do more of that now, like more just, it's like a different sort of thing, you know, like a short story and like a folk tale sort of thing.
They definitely have that vibe. And I'm curious, when you were writing the story, did you find yourself more connected to the main character or the brother?
Well, depending on, you know, if you read the story and, you know, you find out the outcome of the story, I don't know, I feel like I felt like both people at some point. So, yeah, I know what it's like to have a younger sibling sort of, you know, go away, I'm doing my own thing. So
do you have any siblings?
I like to be shunned. Yeah, I have two younger sisters.
Oh, nice.
I love them, though. I don't mean to say anything like, oh, like, I go away. Yeah, in the past, yeah, maybe when I was younger.
Oh, of course. When you're the older sibling, you kind of say, hey, you're annoying, go away, I'm too cool for you. And
yeah, so cool. I was such a cool teenager.
We all were. So did any of your experiences growing up kind of, like, feed into this story?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I never actually, like, did anything like that and met up with a group of friends and told scary stories in that sort of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I did do a lot of, not when I was, like, a kid that young, but in my earlier 20s, like Joe and I actually used to go to a lot of places that, like, we would go to vaults and, like, random cemeteries and stuff and kind of investigate.
Nice. That's awesome.
One of the other stories you read was called Delaying Decay, which is about two boys finding something very strange in a funeral home. This is one of my favorites from the book. It felt very much like it was set in the 1950s somewhere in the South, at least in my head. And what was your inspiration for this story?
Yeah, so this story is actually set in the fictional town of Leicestershire, which is where we set a lot of our stories in our books. Leicestershire is actually the name, the former name of Johnson City, which is where we grew up. And yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, everybody knows what it's like to be a kid on a, you know, like a summer day and be kind of bored and yeah, sort of going around town and like being mischievous and whatnot. Yeah, totally that 50s thing. I think I could see where you're coming from with that. I don't even know why. It's one of those things I can't even put a pin down. But I see where you're at. I see where you're at with that.
Yeah, kind of like an It vibe, like when they were younger and or like a Stand By Me or something. I kind of had that vibe when I was reading it. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's probably was in our subconscious or something when we were writing it. Sure.
Yeah, those stories kind of weave into our brains.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And once the kids descend down into the basement of the funeral home, what's going on down there, the way you described it was really awesome. It kind of reminded me of Return of the Living Dead, which I just kind of giggled inside when I was reading it.
Okay, cool. Again, that was not intentional, but yeah, we like that movie as well. Yeah, so they go down there, and they're witness to a procedure on an elderly woman on one of those, like, a slab. It's a pretty ghastly thing. And
I know.
Giving anything away.
It's kind of hard talking about your stories because so much of them, like, have this great setup.
Yeah.
And then go. Like, that twist ending you were talking about, you just, like, bam, like, into the next thing. Which it's like, especially in your story, an Epistle from the Dead, where a mom finds a diary of her recently deceased husband and things happen. But that, oh my God, that one's just messed up where you took that. I like how, like, connected we felt to the mother's headspace and how she was, like, disconnected from the rest of the world as she was reading this thing. And I'm curious, like, how did you and Joseph, like, get into that headspace there and be so honest with that, with her emotional reaction?
That is a good question. Yeah, like I said, it's kind of hard when it's the two of us, because I can't really speak to Joe exactly. Mm-hmm. I think we were actually having this conversation earlier about trying to be authentic and something we're trying, a story we're trying to tell or a scene we're trying to tell. And Joe actually said to me, and he's like, literally, you should just go and write what you said back then. Because it's like, you know, and put your stuff in that headspace and what you were thinking, what you wanted to say to this person.
And the twist at the end of where, I believe that's where the real dread lies in the story.
Oh, yeah.
And I really appreciate that, because some endings in a story you can see coming a mile away, and by the time you actually get to the end of the story, it really lessens the impact and kind of feels soft at the end, whereas this one was really, really kind of a punch to the face.
It made it worse. Like, finding out what the truth behind this was made it so much worse.
It's a little tragic, I guess.
It really is. It was just like, I don't know, kind of classic, and it's just like depth of tragedy there.
Yeah, we sort of took something worse, and it took something bad and made it worse. But the funny thing with that, I guess that's a good instance of sort of our core writing thing. And this is sort of self-serving, because it'll make me look good over Joe, but not really. And so Joe actually wrote the story and sort of ended it at the part where, you know, before it transitioned.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know. Yeah. So he ended it there. And I was just like, well, I was like, but what's the twist, Joe? Like, I was just like, when you got to have that twist or something that sort of like is a little more unexpected and whatnot. Because I just felt like, okay, yeah, sure. That's sure. Maybe she would, you know, that would happen.
It's definitely, to me, it reminded me of like bad breakups.
Yeah.
You know, like when somebody leaves you like a breakup letter or something, and they're like, oh, I'm not going to talk to you face to face. Here's a letter, because I'm a coward and I'm not going to tell you why. Mm. And you just read it and you never saw it coming. And it's kind of like this gut punch. So I've kind of experienced similar things where I've gotten like breakup letters instead of face to faces. So, yeah, it kind of reminded me of that.
Ooh.
That's rough. That's so low. I've also been a victim of that. And that's just terrible. Oh God, have some backbone. But,
yeah, seriously.
But yeah, that sort of thing. I think like one of the like most horrific things is actually finding something out about someone that you know you trust and who you love, and turning out to be like a bad thing.
So the next story that we did want to talk about was Perpetual Subject. That one had me just like gasping. So this story was about a girl doing a year-long photo project, and to her dismay, something keeps getting closer in every photo, and it's really disturbing. Seriously, this was very I was just like, I kept like yelling at my Kindle. I was just like, what? No! I was very shocked, and like, this is the one where, like, before we started properly recording, I was like, time travel. I see a theme. John, I do want to ask you, like, what is your fascination with time travel? Because I see a lot of that in elements in your stories, like, throughout this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been huge into time travel ever since I was a little kid. The first movie that I, like, really, really fell in love with was Back to the Future. And that was probably going back like as early as elementary school. Well, it was, because I remember specifically dressing up like Marty McFly in like third grade.
Awesome.
I wear this like jean jacket with like my puffy coat over it and this white. I mean, I went full on. I had the red shirt, I had the white button up and the Nikes. Like, I just went full on with it. And so I've always been into that, piqued by that idea. I mean, Bill and Ted and stuff like that. I see a lot of time travel movies. There's this really cool one called Time Crimes from like several years ago. Did you guys see that?
No, I haven't seen that one.
That screws with your mind so much. You got to check that out. But yeah, that just the idea of going back in time and being able to change things. And I don't know, there's something about it that's just so fun and interesting.
Have you seen the movie Safety Not Guaranteed?
I have not seen that. I think I might have. Is it got time travel in it?
Yes.
Okay. I think I've actually probably read, I've read a lot of blogs that are like, the best time travel movies, and, you know, stuff like that, and I think that's probably why.
Yeah, it's an excellent film. I think it's really interesting. It's more of like a love letter to kind of years gone past. This guy's seemed kind of stuck in his past life, and in this one moment that specifically defines him, and he wants to go in the past, so he puts on a post, like a blind post, saying looking time traveler looking for companion, safety not guaranteed. in the paper, and so this lady who's a journalist, she, you know, jumps in, she sees like a story there, and then slowly but surely she kind of gets to know this gentleman and tries to figure out whether this guy is really a time traveler, or he has the ability to time travel, or whether he's more interesting than the concept of what he's trying to accomplish, if it's real or not.
Okay, I need to see that.
I really enjoyed Perpetual Subject as a story, but I found myself a little sad about the somewhat unresolved bullying issue. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
But yeah, in terms of resolving that, I guess, I feel like maybe we missed out on that, on an opportunity.
Yeah, it's a really impactful story.
Yeah, it is.
I definitely was hoping it went in another direction at the end, but I did understand, like, I really kind of wanted to understand what she was thinking. But I guess the mystery of it adds to the melancholy, like a modern version of a classic ghost story where you really don't get all the bits and pieces, and it just kind of, that melancholy kind of washes over the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it might have, now that I think about it, it might have been something that Joe and I sort of brought up, and it was one of those things like, no, we don't need to like tie that end up.
And I kind of like where it ended though. Simply because it allowed her as a character to go from being kind of a classic ignored victim to something a little bit more powerful. But I'll pause that conversation there. And guys, again, if you're curious, you should go read the book, because that's all we're going to tell you. And so, John, what else are you working on currently?
As I mentioned before, we're actually working on a book with Chad Worley, fully illustrated book in this vein. Like, so it's short story, folklore, sort of urban legends.
Awesome. And are you going to, is the overall like feel of the writing going to be similar to this one, or are you kind of like branching further into a different style on this next collection?
I think it's definitely, there's a lot of similarities. I think there is a lot of that same sort of folkloric, sort of direct storytelling, but we are trying to, just for our own personal progression as writers, to delve a little more into description and building dread in that sort of way,
mm-hmm.
Which is something we haven't really focused on as much before. We're just plot addicts. We're just like plot, plot, the plot. And, yeah, I think building, you know, I think people who read horror and fantasy and that sort of stuff like that visceral, you know, description, dread building sort of thing. So that's something there's going to be more of that in our future.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I think if our audience, anybody in our audience that really enjoys short horror fiction, something just really satisfying to write, read before bed, you know, these kind of quick but powerful and really kind of stories that stay with you. I really enjoyed this book, and I think that they will enjoy it as well. So, John, where can our audience find more of your work and Joseph's works as well?
So I would probably suggest you just go to Amazon and searching Varel and Sullivan. But actually, really the best thing is to just follow us on social media. We're pretty active on social media. I mean, we have a website, but it's not updated nearly as much as like our Facebook and Instagram. So on Facebook, it's facebook.com/cemeterygatesmedia. On Instagram, it's also Cemetery Gates Media, I want to say, or Cemetery Gates M. Cemetery Gates M is our username. And then I'm also really active on Twitter. I'm at John Burrell, JOHNBRHEL.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will have all of these links in our show notes on podcast.ninthstory.com/519
actually.
519.
519. Wow. We're both sleepy.
Oh my gosh. And we also turned off our fans, and now the heat's just like starting to bake into our brains. So
yeah.
Thank you for turning off yours and talking with us. Not your brain, but your fan.
Maybe I turn that up too.
Nah. But thank you so much for joining us, John, and thank you for sharing your book with us. Like, that was an incredible read. I'm so glad.
Thank you.
It was right
yeah,
on.
Thank you so much, John.
Right on par.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy that you guys enjoyed it, and I'm sure Joe will be Over the Moon and enjoy it as well. And thanks a lot, guys, for having me on here.
Thank you guys for listening. This has been The Ninth Story, and if you need any of the show notes or anything we've talked about, you will find it on podcast.ninthstory.com/519. And if you want to talk to us about it, you can find us on Twitter. That's the best place to find us, at Ninth Story Podcast.
And if you enjoy The Ninth Story Podcast, you should please, please, please go check out The Wicked Library Podcast. They have amazing short horror stories, extraordinarily performed. So if you like the stories that we do at the beginning of the show, if you want something a little more produced, a little more pizzazz, and just story, story, story with a cool interview at the back end done by Miss Andromeda.
That's me.
You can go check out The Wicked Library on Stitcher or any podcatcher that you use.
And question of the day.
Question of the week.
Question of the week. Oh, I guess it is a weekly question, isn't it? We only talk to you once a week.
Yes.
Unless you talk to us on Twitter. In which case, it is a question of the day. However, question of the week is, in what sweltering pit of hell?
Mm-hmm. Keep going. My brain is going.
Do you think all of the left socks go to?
Yeah. That's a good question. Tweet us at Ninth Story Podcast on Twitter. Please follow us on Twitter. We have a brand new Twitter account specifically just for this show. Please follow us over there. We have a paltry 70 people following us, but we love you all that do follow us.
Hey, don't call them chickens.
Not poultry, paltry. But we want more. We want everybody. All of our authors do follow us that have been on the show. Do follow us on Twitter. So if you want to be part of a bigger conversation or ask us something specific or tell us about where you think all the left socks have gone, find us on Twitter at Ninth Story Podcast.
Regardless of that, stay creative, my friends.
Bazinga.
That is not our catchphrase. Erase that from your memory.
Oh, God.
Good job. Oh, no. Not that. Oh, you shouldn't have erased that. Sorry.
Bye-bye.
Hello. Welcome to Skype Call Testing Service. After the beep, please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
Hey, Skype, you're a loud, loud lady.
Shut your mouth, Skype.
Oh.
Waka chaka, waka chaka, waka chaka.
Hey, Skype, you're a loud, loud lady.
Shut your mouth, Skype.
Oh.
Waka chaka.
If you are able to hear your own voice, then you have configured Skype correctly. If you hear this message, but not your own voice, and something is wrong with your audio recording settings, please check your microphone and microphone settings or visit skype.com for more help. Thank you for using the Skype call testing service. Goodbye.
Shut your mouth.
Goodbye, Skype. Until next week.